Bum bum bottom bum bottom bum bum bottom bum bum bottom bum bottom bum bottom bum bum bottom bum bum. Welcome to Everyday Musicality, the podcast in which we discuss all things related to Gordon's music learning theory and how it can help unlock the inner musician that lives inside of all of us. I'm your host, Heather Scholdeis, music educator and faculty member for the Gordon Institute for Music Learning. In this episode, I answer a listener question about Kerwin hand signs and MLT-based instruction. Hello and welcome to the Everyday Musicality Podcast. I want to start with a reminder that I will be announcing the giveaway winner at the end of this episode. So stick around to see if you have won the Audiate Guitar Method Bundle from GIA Publications. I also want to make sure that I say thank you to Patreon supporter Felicity B for increasing her continued support of the podcast. If you would also like to support me in this work, you can visit patreon.com/everydaymusicality. Before we get into today's topic, I wanted to let you know about a research study I'm conducting in case you might be eligible to participate and would like to. Technically, because this is a research study, I have approved protocol that I need to follow. So I'm going to read the participant recruitment message that was approved by my institution's IRB. If you're not familiar with what IRB means, it stands for Institutional Review Board, and they are the people who look at all the applications for research that would involve human subjects to make sure that things will be conducted in an ethical way. So here's my recruitment message. I'm conducting a survey of elementary general music teachers' use of learning sequence activities, or LSAs, in their teaching practice, including teachers' decisions whether to use LSAs and any adaptations they choose to make. You do not need to use LSAs in order to participate in this study. The only eligibility criteria are 1. You currently teach elementary general music, and 2. You have completed an Elementary General Music Level 1 Professional Development Levels course, or PDLC, through the Gordon Institute for Music Learning in the past 10 years. That's summer 2013 through present. If you fit these criteria, I would like to invite you to complete a brief online survey. The survey should take 10 to 15 minutes to complete, is completely voluntary and confidential, and can only be taken once. You may read more about this survey and enter your responses if you so choose here, and I'll add the link. Thank you for taking the time to help us learn about elementary music teachers' implementations of LSAs. So I'll add that text to the show notes and provide the link to the survey if you're eligible and you would like to participate. Again, you're eligible to complete the survey if you currently teach elementary general music and you've completed Elementary General Level 1 through GIML in the past 10 years. Also a side note, if you have taken GIML Level 1 Elementary General, but not within the past 10 years, so not since summer 2013, stay tuned because I may be expanding the criteria for participation in order to get more responses. Also, I want to encourage you to complete the survey, not just because it is for a research study that I'm hoping the results of which could be published in GIML's journal, the GIML Audia, but the results of this survey will help inform the revision of the learning sequence activities materials published by GIA Publications. That's right. Before Dr. Gordon passed away, he gave Cindy Taggart permission to work on revising the learning sequence activities materials. So a team that includes Cindy Taggart and myself are currently working on re-envisioning the materials for teaching learning sequence activities. This includes both re-examining the content that's included, so the specific patterns. It also includes re-examining the order in which the pages are presented and making the materials more user-friendly for teachers. So again, right now, to be eligible to complete the survey, you need to have taken Elementary General Music Level 1 in the past 10 years and be currently teaching Elementary General Music. If that applies to you, please take a few moments to complete the survey because not only will it participate in our research, but it will help make these materials even better for teachers. And again, if you haven't taken level one in the past 10 years, if it's been longer than 10 years, stay tuned because I may still be asking you for your help. Finally, two more quick notes before I get into the topic of the day. In my last episode, I was wrong about the Gimmel Spring 2023 online workshop. It will actually be on Saturday, May 6th at 9 a.m. to noon Eastern Time. And the presenter will be Dr. Beth Bolton. Dr. Bolton will present a workshop called Audiation Soup, New Tunes for a New Era. Remember that these quarterly online workshops are free for Gimmel members, and it's not too late to join. You could visit the Gimmel website, giml.org, and you could become a member today, and you would still have plenty of time to attend the quarterly workshop for free on May 6th. But you need to register by May 3rd. That's for everybody. Online registration closes at the end of the day on May 3rd. I'll link in the show notes to more information, which includes the online registration form. Finally, before I get into today's topic, I wanted to share with you one more event that you may be interested in, and it's another virtual event, but it's not just involving music learning theory. The National Association for Music Education, or NAFME, will be holding a virtual general music conference on April 29th at 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll put a link in the show notes with information about that event. More information also will be coming. But this is an event that is designed to expose music teachers to the various approaches, the various teaching approaches for general music. So there will be a representative for the ORF approach and a representative for the Kodai approach and for Dalcroze and for the Feyerabend approach and also for Gimmel. And so I will actually be filling that role on April 29th. I'll be giving a 35-minute presentation that will introduce folks to a little bit of the ideas behind music learning theory, as well as lots of teaching strategies. And then each of the other approaches will also have someone who's going to be presenting for 35 minutes. During that time, I can't remember everything that's going to be going on, but I know a piece of it is going to be a later in the day, an opportunity for you to chat with representatives from each of those music teaching organizations to find out more about the approach and how you can get involved in the organization. I think this event is free, and I don't believe you have to be a NAFME member. So check out that link if you would like to attend that NAFME General Music Conference on April 29th from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. via Zoom. Okay, now let's get into today's topic. If you've been listening to the last few episodes, you've heard me share that I've been having some problems with my voice for the last couple of months, and as you can probably hear, it still isn't 100%. But a week from this Wednesday, I have my appointment, my three-hour-long appointment at the University of Michigan Vocal Health Center. So hopefully they will help me. But I did luck out because I recently received an email from a listener with a question that I thought would make a good topic for a quick episode, and that doesn't require me to sing. So I received this question from Julie in Texas. Julie emailed, "I had a question about using Kerwin hand signs. Do you use them in MLT? Do you start with them at verbal association or later or never? I was taught to always use the hand signs with solfege, but I could see how this could become a symbol and a crutch. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts." Well, thank you so much for that great question, Julie. I thought it's easier for me to talk about this than explain in an email, though I did give you a brief response. I thought this would make for an interesting conversation on the podcast. So first, I want to say that just as I don't think that any teaching approach is universally right or wrong, I don't believe there are universally good teaching techniques or universally bad teaching techniques. There are just different teaching techniques and different approaches. And it's our job as music educators to choose the approach or combination of approaches that aligns with our personal teaching philosophy, and then to choose the teaching techniques that will support our philosophy and chosen teaching approach. I talked about this back in episode 42, in which I discussed choosing a tonal solfege or rhythm syllable system. There are no universally good or bad syllable systems, but we have to choose a system that makes sense given our teaching approach. I'll link to that episode in the show notes in case you'd like to go back and listen. So I'm not going to talk about Kerwin hand signs as good or bad. Rather, I'll answer this question in light of the degree to which Kerwin hand signs align with the tenets of MLT. So first, let's look at the question of whether to use hand signs at the verbal association skill level. Remember that at verbal association, students learn to associate signs to the sounds they've learned to audiate at the aural-oral level previously. I talked about both the aural-oral and the verbal association levels of learning back in two previous mini-series of episodes. I'll link to the first one of each of those mini-series in the show notes in case you want to brush up on aural-oral or verbal association. Back in episode 41, in which I gave an introduction to the verbal association skill level, I talked about how tonal solfege and rhythm syllables should act as signs, not symbols. The difference between signs and symbols is that signs are something we hear, while symbols are something we see. Now, I talked about this difference between signs and symbols back in that mini-series on verbal association because I was making the point that solfege should be heard and performed, but not seen at the verbal association skill level. If students were seeing solfege, if they were reading or writing solfege spelled out in letters visually, then the syllables would be acting as symbols. And this would mean that students would be inadvertently engaging in a form of symbolic association. I also pointed out that often when a teacher puts solfege into writing, as in writing out the solfege for an entire song, it acts as a crutch for students to essentially decode the written symbols as opposed to truly audiating. So to ensure that solfege is used in a manner that supports audiation rather than replaces or contradicts it, Gordon strongly recommended that syllables serve only as a sign and not as a symbol. In other words, solfege should be heard and performed, but not seen. Getting back to Kerwin hand signs, if we were to add Kerwin hand signs at verbal association, the hand signs would be acting as symbols because they would be something that we see. It would technically not be appropriate, according to the tenets of MLT, to incorporate symbols at the verbal association skill level. And again, that's because we use things like solfege to help solidify audiation and give labels to what we're audiating before we start to see what we're audiating in symbols. That's one of the very important things about the sequence of MLT is that we experience sounds, and then we put syllables to the sound and start to label and categorize sounds that we're audiating before we transition into notation, into symbolic representation of the sounds that we're audiating. So this is not to say that you can't incorporate Kerwin hand signs at the verbal association skill level. This is simply to share the reasoning why Gordon didn't encourage Kerwin hand signs in MLT-based instruction, particularly at the verbal association level, because he didn't want students to be inadvertently forced to do some sort of reading or decoding of symbols at the verbal association level. It should simply be continuing to develop your audiation of musical sounds and now also adding the layer of hearing and performing syllables and using those syllables to label and categorize the sounds that you're hearing. So that's why many MLT teachers tend to not incorporate Kerwin hand signs at the verbal association level. Not to say that you can't. You can do whatever you want. But many MLT teachers don't incorporate Kerwin hand signs at the verbal association level because those would be a symbol. So, Julie, you hit the nail on the head in your email when you said that you could see how associating hand signs with solfege could become a symbol and a crutch. You nailed it. There are a couple other reasons why the GIMEL faculty members don't encourage the use of Kirwan hand signs in our professional development levels courses and other teacher professional development. Another reason is because Kirwan hand signs are not as useful when we're looking at music from a harmonic standpoint and from a tonality standpoint, because Kirwan hand signs represent individual pitches, right? So for example, if we're in major, then do would be our first scale degree, and we would make a fist when we're singing do. And if we were to sing up the scale, so in major would be the fifth scale degree. So we're holding our hand with our palm facing us, right? With our thumb up and our palm facing us for so. So take, for example, if you were singing chord roots with a song in major tonality, do, do, so, do. Pardon my voice. We would be using that fist for do, and then our palm facing us with our thumb up for so. But what happens if we're singing a song in minor tonality? Well, now, mi, fa, mi, re, do, ti, si, la. Now our resting tone is la. Pardon my voice. So now we've got to make that curved shape with our hands, where our fingers and thumb are curving down, are pointing downward with our palm curved for la, for the first scale degree. Pardon my voice. This is why I have not been singing with you. And then for the fifth scale degree in minor, mi, we would have to use our palm facing down with our hand parallel with the floor. So now we would be doing la, la, mi, la, with two totally different hand signs. Because again, each hand sign represents that particular pitch. So when we're using movable do with a la bass minor, the first scale degree is going to be a different solfege syllable in every tonality, which means that the hand sign we're using for the resting tone has to change. Now, this might not be such a problem. In fact, maybe it could be a handy thing. I don't know, because I'm not personally a user of the Kirwan hand signs. But think about if we're going to be teaching harmonic skills. One big thing that we want students audiating is harmonic progression, to be audiating the harmonic underpinnings of the music that they're hearing, singing, and playing. So if we were going to be, as I just mentioned, doing chord roots in a particular tonality, one of the benefits of using chord numbers is that when we're using, for example, in minor tonality, if we're doing la, la, mi, la, we're using 1, 1, 5, 1, right? That's what we're showing on our hand. Well, if we were doing a song in major, sol, la, sol, fa, mi, re, ti, do, we would still be showing 1, 1, 5, 1, and singing do, do, so, do. So I think chord numbers are helpful because they show that function can stay kind of, I don't know if consistent is the right word, but you know, like similar or parallel across tonalities. So home is always going to be tonic. So when we're singing chord roots, no matter what tonality, when music comes back to home, that tonic chord, we're always showing one. Right? And then we just change in some tonalities like major, minor, Lydian. We might be showing 5 for the dominant and then back to tonic. Or in some tonalities like Dorian, Phrygian, Mixolydian, we might be showing 1 and then 7 instead of the dominant. We've got a subtonic chord and back to 1. By the way, side note, I may have mentioned this in a previous episode, to show hand numbers for a 7 chord, I don't hold up 7 fingers because that's pretty cumbersome. I just use my pointer finger, but point it downward. I think I got that idea from Butch Marshall, also a GIMEL faculty member. So thank you, Butch, for that idea. Oh, and Butch is also the current GIMEL president. So thanks, Butch, for that great idea. So getting back to harmonic understanding, it really helps using chord numbers instead of Kirwan hand signs if we are using those numbers, because they help kids develop a similar understanding of chord function regardless of tonality, because home is always one. It's always tonic. Now, really quickly, I do want to mention that, you know, the same criticism I said earlier about Kirwan hand signs, that they could be a symbol. I mean, that is sort of true of chord numbers, right? If we're showing the number on our hand. But I like to think of it as, before we're showing the numbers, we're modeling the chord roots, so the students are starting to get a sense of how to audiate those chord changes before we're going to formally teach them the chord roots and show them the numbers on our hands at the same time. You know, honestly, I wish Dr. Gordon were still here so we could have more of a conversation about why it would be acceptable to show chord numbers, why that's not more of a, you know, a no-no at verbal association. But I acknowledge that it is somewhat of a symbol. But getting back to another benefit of showing chord numbers on your hand instead of Kirwan hand signs is that a Kirwan hand sign represents that pitch, right? For example, if we're in major, do is just the first scale degree, so is just the fifth scale degree. But if we're using chord numbers, we could be singing chord roots where one would be where do is the chord root, five would be where it's so. Or once students can do chord roots, we could expand and we could be doing harmony. We could be singing the chord tones in harmony. So this is where in a previous episode, I did the thing where you split the kids up into different groups and you harmonize in different ways. So for example, one group, instead of singing do and so, they would be singing do and ti. And another group would be singing mi and fa. And another group would be singing so and so. So when you're showing a one, the three groups would each be singing one of the pitches of do, mi, or so to make a tonic chord. And when we show dominant, when we're doing that three-part harmony, when we show a five, we would have ti, fa, and so. So now we're using those same chord numbers, but instead of just representing chord roots, we can use those numbers to also indicate the full chord. So harmonizing the chord tones. Also, I think that chord numbers translate really nice to when we get to notation and we start doing things like Roman numeral analysis. Yes, students, even in elementary school, can start to do Roman numeral analysis. It doesn't just have to wait until you get to theory class in college. So for example, my fourth graders, we would play recorder. They would learn simple tunes and bass lines and eventually start reading tonal patterns and rhythm patterns from notation, because they had, you know, lots of exposure to pattern instruction previously before we got to recorder. So once we got into more notation, started reading songs and bass lines on a recorder, we would take a familiar song, just simple major song that uses a tonic and dominant chord progression. We would practice writing in the Roman numerals above the various measures of the notation to show where the chord changes were. So Roman numeral 1 for tonic and Roman numeral 5, V for dominant. And then we would write a partner song. The kids would compose their own partner songs for that familiar song using its chord progression. They would take a blank staff. They would write in the chord progression over the measures just as they had learned it in the familiar song. And then they would compose their own song that fit that chord progression that they had written out in Roman numerals. And they would notate the song they were creating. So all this to say, I think that using chord numbers gives us a lot of bang for our buck musically, because we can do so much more with chord numbers than we can with Kirwan hand signs, because the chord numbers can represent more than just an isolated pitch. Finally, Gordon himself didn't espouse the use of hand signs, mainly because he saw them as unnecessary. I remember him saying how some people would really press him and say that using hand signs was important for students who are visual or kinesthetic learners. Now, first, there's the fact that there is actually little valid scientific evidence that we each have a natural dominant learning style, or that matching instruction to individual students' purported preferred learning style results in better learning. I'll link to a couple articles about that in the show notes in case you'd like to read more, but basically, research shows that as much as we would like to claim that teaching to students' supposed preferred learning style helps them learn better, it's not really the case. There isn't really much evidence that actually says that. So the idea of needing to teach to different individual learning styles has basically been debunked. But even back when Gordon was alive and still teaching, I remember him saying that we don't need hand signs if we are audiating. If we need to depend on a visual sign to help us figure out or find what a pitch should sound like, then we're not truly audiating. We are not internalizing the pitches in our audiation. If students are learning in a way that facilitates audiation, he would say they shouldn't need hand signs to help them figure out the sounds of the pitches, because audiation will equip them for knowing what the pitches should sound like and placing them within a tonal context. Gordon would say that music is aural, A-U-R-A-L. Music is aural, so we shouldn't resort to visual cues, but rather should help students develop audiation. There was an article published in The Atlantic in 2018 called The Myth of Learning Styles, in which the author points out, quote, "Most of the tasks that we encounter are really suited to only one type of learning. You can't visualize a perfect French accent, for example," end quote. I'll link to that in the show notes. That was exactly the point Gordon was trying to get across. So this person is saying that you can't visualize a perfect French accent. You have to hear a perfect French accent, and you have to start to imitate that perfect French accent and figure out how to incorporate that French accent into your own speech. You have to do it by hearing and doing. That it's not something you're really truly going to learn and master through a visual. And again, this is exactly the point Gordon was trying to get across, but with music. That music is aural. It's something we hear. Therefore, it's most appropriately learned aurally. That's not to say that we never use visual or kinesthetic experiences in MLT-based instruction. Of course we do. But the primary way that we experience music is aurally. So helping students learn aurally and develop audiation should be our focus in MLT-based instruction if we subscribe to the core tenet of audiation. Speaking of core tenets, in the very first three episodes of this podcast, I talked about three of the core tenets that I believe are the core tenets of MLT. So I'll link to those three in the show notes as well if you'd like to go back and listen to those. And again, this is not to say that there's anything wrong with hand signs, or that you can't use them in MLT-based instruction. Those were just some of the reasons why Gordon was not a proponent of using Kerwood hand signs in MLT-based instruction, and why many MLT teachers and the Gimmel faculty members aren't necessarily encouraging folks to use Kerwood hand signs. So not to say that you can't or you shouldn't, but you might want to think about the purpose those hand signs are serving and if they're accomplishing the goals that we espouse as MLT practitioners. So if we really believe, first and foremost, that audiation is the key, then we really should be teaching in a way that encourages audiation to the greatest extent possible. So I'll leave it at that, and I want to say thanks again for that great question, Julie. And now it's time to announce the winner of the most recent giveaway from sponsor GIA Publications. In the last episode, I spoke with the authors of the brand new Audiate Guitar Method and announced that we would be giving away a free bundle that includes the teacher book and both student book one and student book two. That bundle is valued at $80 from GIA Publications. After entering all of the names into a random number generator, the winner came out to be Amanda Burton Gomez. Amanda, please send an email to everydaymusicality@gmail.com with your preferred mailing address, and I will get in contact with GIA to have them ship you that bundle right away. In the meantime, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch. You can email me or send me a voice memo at everydaymusicality@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and let's keep musicking every day.